of rubble. That almost, almost made Gemma smile. She and April had hurled their biology textbooks onto the train tracks once, just to watch them get mowed over, even though both of their parents docked them allowance for the cost of a replacement. There was no ladder, no booster rocket, no flare gun or charged cell phone. Big surprise. The well walls were moss-slicked, but studded with rocks that made decent handholds. She wished now more than ever she'd been allowed to participate in gym. Her mom had always insisted she be excused, claiming a weak heartbeat, concerned that Gemma might flatline in the middle of a game of dodgeball, and that she'd learned rock climbing during the aerial unit last fall. She couldn't climb one-handed anyway, but when she tried to use her left hand, thinking that with four good fingers she'd be okay, the pain was so bad she nearly peed herself and stumbled backward, gasping. So, she couldn't climb. She thought of piling all the rotted wood together, stacking it carefully in a crosshatch pattern, hoping that by some miracle of geometry she would be able to climb the pile like a footstool and reach the top of the well. But the wood was soft and rotten, and there wasn't much of it to begin with. It boosted her barely a foot. Her voice was still shot, still coming out in a bare croak, like the throaty wail of a dying frog. Stretching onto her tiptoes, she managed to get a hand around a root exploding through the rot between stones. Maybe she could climb it, brace her feet against the wall and get some leverage. It would take her only a quarter of the way toward the top, but a quarter of the way was better than nothing. But here again, she failed. She could barely support her weight with one arm, and her feet slipped as the wood rot crumbled beneath her. She slammed into the wall with a shoulder and dropped on her knees, remembering, at least, to shield her left hand so she didn't accidentally put pressure on it. She sat there, panting, her nose leaking snot into the mud. She was too scared even to cry. She might actually die here. Here, at the bottom of some shitty 100-year-old well, in a state she didn't even like. She would die a virgin, alone, unloved. Funnily enough, it wasn't Pete she thought of then, or April, or even her mom. It was Lyra, the way she looked when Gemma had last seen her. Still fragile, but also full of life. Something hatching. When Gemma closed her eyes, she could hear Lyra's voice, whispering to her across a distance. "Gemma," her voice said. "Gemma." Gemma's heart nearly cracked. She opened her eyes again. But still, she could hear Lyra's voice. Louder now. "Gemma? Gemma?" And Selim's, too, a lower, deeper echo of hers.
"Gemma. Gemma."
She climbed to her feet. She couldn't quite believe it. They were so distant, she almost feared she really had snapped, and that what she heard was just the transformation of her memory into sound. But no, there was an unfamiliar voice, too, a man's voice. And how could she remember something she'd never heard? That meant they were here, close. Instantly, she was seized by terror. They wouldn't hear her. They would leave, like the police had left, and no one would ever think to look for her here again. The rock was still where she'd dropped it, exhausted, after an hour of banging fruitlessly, hoping someone would come. She picked it up again and slammed it hard against the slick wall, and the noise it made was of an old stone mouth, clicking its tongue in disapproval. Not loud enough. Was it her imagination, or were the voices receding already? She banged the stone again and again. Now she was crying, from terror and frustration. How could they not hear? How could they not see? Of course, she hadn't seen it either. The well was separated from the houses by 100 yards and tucked behind a stand of trees. She thought of throwing something into the air in case they happened to be looking in her direction. But it was no use. She could barely lob the rock 10 feet in the air, much less hope to break through the wood that Calliope had used to conceal the opening. The well smelled like her own sweat, like a hard panic. She wasn't imagining it. Lyra's voice was receding. They, too, were going away. She was shaking, and burning hot, too. She shook off the wool vest she'd taken from the farmhouse. A sudden vision of the boy, red-faced and raged, pointing at her, as the wagon crested the swell of the hill, overwhelmed her. And as she did, the cigarettes and the peeling lighter thudded out of one pocket. Gemma's breath seized in her throat. Could she? It had been raining on and off all night. The wood was damp, although not as damp as it could have been. Calliope had done her this favor by covering the well. She bent down. The lighter was cool in her hand. She thumbed a flame to life and was shocked by how vivid it was, how bright against the darkness. Could she? It was risky. It was dangerous. She remembered how quickly the airport bathroom had filled with smoke, how quickly she'd felt she couldn't breathe. She had no idea how far Lyra and Selim had traveled already, and whether they'd even see the smoke. On the other hand, she didn't know how much longer she'd survive. And what had Calliope said? In all the stories, there's always a fire.
Lyra, 25. The dawn came, weak and watery, bringing a patter of light rain. Lancaster was long spools of dark green, fields and forests. At any other time, Lyra thought it would be peaceful. But now, helicopters motored down over the nature preserve and hovered there like giant mosquitoes, unmarked but obviously military-grade. There were snipers wearing camouflage visible inside. "You're sure you want to be here?" Detective Reinhardt asked, and Lyra realized she'd been clenching her fists so hard she'd left marks. She nodded. "I want to help Gemma," she said. "Gemma helped me." But she was afraid. She was afraid she would not be able to help. She was afraid of the suits, afraid Detective Reinhardt wouldn't be able to protect her, afraid that he would try. But she could no longer be invisible. Detective Reinhardt drove slowly, showing his badge whenever they were stopped, which was often. The interstate was completely blocked off between the exits to Logue and Middletown, as were all the local roads bordering the Sequoia Falls Nature Preserve. Police had come from all over the state, some of them on their days off. Detective Reinhardt had said little since they'd reached Lancaster and had ordered Lyra and Selim to stay in the car with the doors locked when he climbed out briefly to speak with a cluster of police officers. But she had picked up rumors, whispers, words carried back to the car like a kind of contamination. There were kids, dozens of them, maybe even more than that, running loose. Not normal kids either. Twins, triplets, even quadruplets. Skinny, feral, covered with blood. "Creepy as shit," she heard one cop say when Reinhardt swung open the door. "Everyone's saying that guy Saperstein must have had them in juvenile lockup, but I never seen a juvenile lockup makes kids like these. It's like something from a horror movie. You can't make this shit up." "You can make up anything you want," Lyra felt like calling out to him, "even horror." But of course she stayed quiet. She imagined the whispers blowing like tiny seeds from one person to the next. Words were little things, of no substance at all, but they were curiously stubborn. They rooted. They grew. It was easy enough for Reinhardt to get through the various cordons. All he had to do was show his badge. Only one trooper seemed interested in Lyra and Selim and leaned down to stare at them in the back seat. "Picked him up 10 minutes ago trying to hitch a ride," Reinhardt said easily, before the trooper could ask. "Must have come from Saperstein's JDC. They won't say where they've been. Got no ID on him." Wordlessly, the trooper backed up and waved them through the line, shouting for another trooper to move the sawhorses out of the way. After that, it was easy enough. They pulled over and Reinhardt nosed his car into a thick entanglement of growth so it was partly concealed. As they climbed out of the car, Lyra could hear the distant whirring of the helicopters and felt the hairs rise on her neck. Reinhardt had gotten a copy of the map the search teams were using to organize their efforts. He had marked the approximate location of each of Gemma's sandals, which had been located several miles apart with a piece of fabric that might have come off her clothing. Selim immediately pointed to several shaded-in squares a fingernail's distance away from where a search crew had turned up her second sandal. "What's that?" he asked Reinhardt. Those are farmhouses? Turn-of-the-century settlement? I'm talking turn of the last century. Three cabins, totally run down, but the police checked the cabins early this morning, he added. I heard it over the radio. Apparently some kid from one of the Amish farms rang up to tip them off about the cabins. He'd walked 7 miles just to find a payphone. Reinhardt smiled. He was scared his parents would find out. I guess the place is popular with teenagers around here when they want to be alone. Some things are the same, from Lancaster to Miami, huh? She couldn't have gone far without any shoes, Lyra said. Reinhardt looked at her. She made it more than 2 miles with only one shoe, he pointed out. Besides, the police were already there. They cleared the cabins. Maybe she hid, Lyra said. She wouldn't know she could trust them. She might think they were coming to get her for what happened on the farm. I thought you said she didn't do it, Reinhardt said. That it was one of the others. He still couldn't say replica. She didn't, Lyra said, but she wouldn't know that they knew that. That was what people did when they escaped. They found a place to hide. Selim had hidden successfully on the island for several days when he was 72, even though there was an armed military guard on the perimeter, even though there must have been 50 people looking for him. It was because he'd stayed on the island, exactly in the middle of where he was supposed to have escaped, that no one had found him. Besides, places had feelings to them, just like objects did. They whispered things, absorbed secrets, and quietly pulsed them back. But most people didn't hear. They didn't know how to listen. Lyra listened, and she heard a whisper even in the lines on the page. A lost and abandoned place for lost and abandoned people. She could have planted the shoes, Detective Reinhardt said. She might have wanted to throw people off her trail. Why would she plant them so far apart? Lyra shook her head. She might be underground. She might be in a basement or hiding under a bed. She could tell that Reinhardt didn't think so, but he folded up the map. Someone's going to find her. They'll stay at it until they do. The dogs will get a scent. The dogs look for dead bodies, Lyra said. She remembered how the soldiers had brought dogs onto the marshes after the explosion to scent the trails of blood. She didn't hate dogs, though. She knew it was just their training. Besides, it rained. She and Selim had slid into the water to avoid being caught, and Cassiopeia had been located instead. Located and then permitted to die. Flagged for collection later. Reinhardt said nothing. There, she said, and pointed again to the ghost silhouettes of the long-abandoned settlements. The paper dimpled beneath her finger and hissed the smallest of words. Yes. It was still raining when they set off into the woods using a compass Reinhardt had on his phone. If they kept straight north from where they'd parked, they would eventually hit the old settlement. It was harder going than Lyra had expected, and she had to stop frequently to rest, overwhelmed by sudden tides of vertigo. She was falling more. It was like there was a wall up between her brain and her body, and only some of the messages made it through. This was, like the holes, a symptom of the disease as it progressed. She'd seen it at Haven, even, though at the time she hadn't known what it was, and had believed it was just a problem in the process going wrong. Replicas got sick, they forgot their numbers, and then how to use the bathroom, and then how to walk and swallow. She was glad neither Reinhardt nor Selim asked her if she wanted to go back, though. Selim just helped her up every time without saying a word, and Detective Reinhardt went ahead scouting the easiest routes and trying to break apart the growth where it was thickest to make it easier for her to pass through. It took several hours, but at last they saw through the tangle of natural growth the hard sloping angle of a roof and a little stone cottage. The settlement had been made in a literal natural clearing, although growth had reclaimed the area, and one house was little more than rubble, punctured by the hardy fists of oak trees that had grown straight up through a collapsed portion of the roof. As soon as Lyra saw the place, her stomach sank. It was obvious that Gemma wasn't here. It took only a few minutes to check the two standing houses. They were each a single room. Inside was a litter of cigarette butts and empty soda cans, but no Gemma. She was glad, too, that Reinhardt didn't gloat about it, or say he told them so. Instead, he said, "I'm sorry. I thought she'd be here." Mira said. Her stomach felt like it had coiled itself around her throat. I really did. She'll turn up, Reinhardt said. I promise. Lyra just shook her head. She knew he was trying to make her feel better, but she knew, too, that it was a promise he had no ability to keep. In the distance, she heard a faint, hollow clacking, the noise of a woodpecker or maybe a squirrel cracking two stones together, an empty sound. Lyra was reluctant to leave. Though Gemma was obviously not here, she kept feeling that she'd missed something, kept turning around to stare even as they began to retrace their steps. The houses, dismal, lurching on their feet, piles of rotten leaves, the trees puncturing the beams, an old circle of stones, maybe a fire pit, or a garden. And not a single sign of movement, nothing but the hollow drumming that made her heart ache with loneliness. They started back the way they'd come, and Detective Reinhardt took the lead again. They'd barely left the cabins behind when they heard him shout. Selim put a hand on Lyra's elbow to help her go faster, and they pushed forward through a leaf-slicked trail marked by the detective's footsteps in the mud. The rain was coming harder, beating its percussion through the trees. She saw Reinhardt moving through the mist toward a girl in a filthy dress, and from a distance, for a second, even Lyra was confused. Gemma. It was Gemma. They'd found her. But immediately the vision passed. The girl's body was wrong and her hair was wrong. The way she stood with her arms very still and tight at her sides was wrong. All of it just a small but critical distance off, like a door hanging an inch off its hinges. Not Gemma. Calliope. Selim realized it too. He dropped Lyra's arm and started to run, an instinct as if he could physically get between Calliope and Reinhardt. Lyra started to call out, but it was too late. Detective Reinhardt had crossed the distance. He reached out to put a hand on her shoulder, even as Selim shouted, "No!" Calliope moved quickly. It was like a sudden pulse of electricity had brought a statue to life. From an angle, Lyra saw only the quick motion of her hand, and then Reinhardt leaning heavily on her shoulder so it looked as if he would pull her into an embrace. Then he released her and stumbled backward, and Lyra saw the knife handle stuck in his abdomen and blood already darkening his shirt. He reached for the gun holstered to his belt, but only grazed the grip before pulling away again quickly, as if it had scalded him. For a split second, just before Selim reached her, Calliope met Lyra's eyes. Lyra was shocked by the feeling. She stopped moving. It was like running into a wall, a huge hand of immovable stone. She thought then of the statue of Richard Haven, which had been built from the wrong stone, so that quickly its face had begun to dissolve in the rain. By the time Lyra was named, its eyes were gone, and its nose and even its lips, so it looked like the blank face of a clock without numbers or hands, like a warning of some terrible future to come where no one could see or speak or hear. Then Calliope turned and ran, wrenching away from Selim when he tried to grab her. Selim hesitated. Lyra knew he was torn between the urge to go after Calliope and the desire to stay with Detective Reinhardt. But they couldn't let Calliope get away. "Go!" Lyra said to Selim. And then, when he still didn't move, "Go!" Finally, he took off after Calliope. She had a head start, but she was weak. He would catch her easily. Lyra dropped next to Detective Reinhardt when he sat down heavily. "I'm okay," he said, but he was chalky-looking, sweating. The good news was that Calliope had stuck him in the stomach, not the chest. She'd missed his heart by a mile. "I'm okay." "You have to keep pressure on it," she told him. "I know, I'm a cop, remember?" He tried to smile, but pain froze his expression into something horrible. "God, when I saw her standing there, she looked so lost." "That was number 7, Lyra said. Calliope didn't deserve her name. Lyra couldn't stand to say it out loud. "Poor kid." Detective Reinhardt coughed and then cursed, his face screwed up with pain. Lyra couldn't believe it. Calliope had stuck him with a knife, had caused him all this pain, and still he felt sorry for her. "Do me a favor. Get my belt off, okay?" She unclipped his duty belt, which was heavy. The gun he carried in his holster was the same as the one Rick Harless had taught her to fire, only a little heavier. A Glock. Lyra thought the word fit. It was a loud, angry word, and it sounded like an explosion. Lyra was suddenly furious. "You should have killed her," she said, thinking of the way Detective Reinhardt had fumbled for his gun. "She would have killed you." Detective Reinhardt shook his head.
"She's just a kid," he said.
"She's a replica," Lyra said, but Detective Reinhardt shook his head again. Lyra saw then that he really truly didn't understand the difference, that to him there was no difference. She had been told she was supposed to love Rick Harless because he was her father and because he loved her, but she had never felt as if she loved him, and she had worried simply that she didn't know how. Even the way she felt about Selim, she thought, might not be love at all, but something different, something she had no name for. Hadn't she heard again and again at Haven that the replicas weren't all the way human? They weren't real people. They were simulations of people precisely because they couldn't love? Damaged, monstrous, soulless? These were all different words for the same thing. But in that moment, and though she hardly knew him at all, she knew absolutely that she loved Detective Reinhardt. It was complete and undeniable, and it changed the whole world around her, like being submerged in a warm bath for the first time. If she could have chosen a father, she would have chosen him. The gun was cold in her hand, but its grip felt familiar. "Stay here," she told him. "I'll be right back." He didn't say anything, and she wasn't sure he'd heard. His whole face was screwed tight around his pain now, as if it, too, had been winched around the knife. She'd been right. It hadn't taken Selim long to catch up to Calliope, and Lyra found them quickly. He had gotten her face down in the wet leaves and pinned her arms behind her back, but she'd obviously fought him. There were deep scratch marks from his cheekbone to his jaw and a bite mark on the back of his hand. When Lyra approached, Calliope tried to lift her head, but she couldn't manage it. She thudded down into the dirt again, one cheek flat to the leaves, the other catching the drive of the rain. But her eye, swollen with rage, rolled toward Lyra like the eye of a spooked animal. Except that Lyra didn't feel sorry for Calliope, not one bit. "I thought you were dead," Calliope said. Because of the way her head was angled, her voice was distorted. It was a terrible version of Gemma's voice. It was the same 15% wrong as the rest of Calliope. Lyra ignored that. She knew Calliope likely meant that she thought Lyra had died on the marshes, but she couldn't help but feel, too, that Calliope had seen immediately how little time she had left, that the disease was starting to show on her skin. "Where's Gemma?" she said. "I don't know any Gemma," Calliope said. And Selim gave her a nudge with his knee. Her tongue appeared quickly to wet her lower lip. She was nervous, and Lyra was glad. "I don't know where she is." Lyra didn't know whether to believe her, but it didn't matter anyway. Calliope would never tell her the truth. "Why'd you do it?" she asked. "You killed that family. You left Gemma to take the blame." "I didn't know what would happen," Calliope said. Then, "Why do you care anyway?" "Gemma's my friend," Lyra said. Calliope's pupil was so large it seemed to swallow all the color in her eye. "Friend," she said, and the rain suddenly changed its pattern through the leaves, creating a ripple sound like laughter. "You were always one of the dumb ones. They'll kill you, you know that, right? They're all the same. They'll pretend to help you, and then they'll hurt you again and again, just like they did at Haven." Lyra had always felt anger as a kind of heat burning through her, but now she was freezing cold, as if from the grip of the gun her whole body was turning to metal very slowly. Calliope had known the truth about Haven just like Selim had, but not Lyra. Was it true then? Was she really just stupid? Was she being stupid now? "Let me go," Calliope said. "You're not going to kill me, so let me go."
"Not until you tell me why," Lyra said.
The trees chittered under the pressure of the rain. They threw the question back at her and made it sound ridiculous. "Cassiopeia was dead," she said. "Number 6 was dead. Numbers 9 and 10, too. They never made it out of the airport. And number 8 doesn't count. Even if she did escape, she couldn't last long. Calliope pulled her mouth into a smile, exposing an incisor tooth graying and sharp.
I wanted to be the only one.
Lyra closed her eyes. She stood and listened and thought of her whole life like a single point of rain, falling down into nothingness. Calliope was still talking, wheedling now, sounding young and afraid, but Lyra could barely hear her.
Let me go, Lyra. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. I was so scared.
It was the strangest thing, as if Calliope wasn't talking at all, as if Lyra was just remembering something she'd said years earlier. She thought of Detective Reinhardt and Gemma lost forever and those people on the farm lying in one another's blood. Detective Reinhardt had said that some people could wear faces, could slip them on like masks. Lyra opened her eyes. Do you remember the baby bird that flew into the glass? She asked. Funnily enough, she felt calm. It flew into the glass and broke a wing. I thought I could nurse it. Calliope frowned.
No,
she said, but Lyra could tell she was lying. She could see it so clearly in her mind, the way its tufted feathers fluttered with every breath, the shuddering of its tiny beak, how scared it was. You stepped on its head to kill it, Lyra said. The barrel of Detective Reinhardt's gun was slick and wet, but she felt it slowly warming in her hand. You said it was the right thing to do because of how it was broken, because there was no hope of fixing it. Calliope went very still. The whole world went still. Even the rain let up momentarily and seemed to gasp midair, deprived even of the will or energy to fall. Calliope's fear smelled like something chemical. Lyra saw her calculating, right answer, wrong answer.
I don't remember,
Calliope said finally, and all the rain unfroze. All of it at once hurtled down fast and thick to break apart as if trying to blow itself back into elements purer than what it had become. The feeling came back to Lyra's hand, warmed her fingers and wrist and arm as she raised the gun. It spread down through her heart, opening and closing like the wings of a bird in her chest. Funny, she said. I never forgot. She didn't need more than one shot, but she fired three anyway. Just to be sure.
Gemma. 26. And then, while she was still hesitating, still trying to decide, three gunshots cracked out in the silence. That settled it. Three gunshots meant a gun and someone to fire it. Someone was still near, and she would take her chances that it was someone who would help, and not Calliope or some psycho Amish guy with a rifle from the 1800s. Maybe Lyra and Selim had even gotten hold of a gun. Maybe they were trying to signal to her. She hoped and prayed that they weren't on the wrong side of the bullet. Either way, she would have to take her chance. Gemma had never built a fire before. Three of the four fireplaces at home were electric and functioned at the push of a button. But she'd watched her mom do it a few times, amused that Christina had once been a tomboy and had spent her summers camping and hiking and hitchhiking between different beach towns. And amused, too, that Christina always got so offended when Gemma said she couldn't imagine it. Quickly, quickly, before they went away. She tore handfuls of paper from the old textbook, saying a silent apology to the book gods for ruining the binding, and was pleased to find many of the pages at the center very dry. They lit up easily, flaming quickly into little bright universes that soon shriveled and burned up to nothing. The wood was harder. She discarded all the wettest pieces and wound up with a small pile that she layered on top of a pyramid of crumpled pieces of paper. It would have to do. She was shocked by how much smoke there was right away. Smoke curled off the wood, as if being planed by an invisible machine. The chemical smell of ink made her cough. She crouched as low as she could, suddenly very afraid. What if the wood did burn so well she quickly couldn't control it? Smoke climbed up the well, rolling from one side to another, like someone rappelling down a cave, but in reverse. Gemma tilted her head and gasped with relief. The smoke had sniffed its way to the open air, had begun to trickle through the narrow gaps in the wood and lift toward the trees. Someone would have to see. Please, God, let someone see. The wood was still smoldering, releasing long tendrils of blue smoke that reminded Gemma of dark hair, that felt like hair in her mouth and her throat. Her eyes and head hurt. Already, the air was very bad. Should she put out the fire? Her head hurt so badly, she had trouble thinking through the pain. One more minute. She would wait one more minute. The wood burst into flame at last. Gemma began to cough. Her head now hurt so badly she couldn't think of anything at all. She was very tired and thought maybe she should just lie down for a while, down in the mud, where it wasn't so hot.
Lyra, 26. The warmth flowed away from her as quickly as it had come. She didn't feel sorry or sad. She didn't feel anything at all. The bullets had ruined Calliope's face and forever destroyed her resemblance to Gemma. There would be only one now. The right one. Still, she wasn't sure whether she had done the right thing or why she felt so little. Maybe there really was something wrong with her. With all of them. What's going to happen? She asked suddenly. She was too afraid to meet Selim's eyes. So she stared instead at the leaves turning to pulp in the rain.
I don't know, he answered.
Selim was always honest. It was one of the things she loved about him. Suddenly she felt like crying.
I'm a replica, really, aren't I? I'm more a replica than anything else.
He touched her face. His fingers were cool and damp. She blinked at him through the rain webbed in her lashes.
You're Lyra, he said.
He smiled and she fell down into his love for her, touching every layer, and this kind of falling was like its opposite, like flying instead.
That's all. That's enough.
Lyra was relieved to find that Detective Reinhardt was on his feet, leaning heavily against a tree. When Selim reached for him, he said,
I'm okay. I'm okay. And even managed to smile.
They had no choice but to give up their search for Gemma. Detective Reinhardt needed help, and it would take longer for someone to find them out here than it would for them to make it back to the car on their own. Slow, one foot in front of the other, stopped to rest. Lyra turned her face to the sky and whispered an apology to Gemma for leaving her behind, for failing. The rain had dropped off, faded to a bare mist, and the leaves shook off their moisture, so it sounded as if high above them, in the cage of the branches, tiny feet jumped from branch to branch. Lyra smelled mulch, rot growth, and the pure, wet sweetness of new blood, of life. Lyra smelled her old life burning. Every day, the past was burned, and you became something new from the ashes. Lyra smelled burning. No, she smelled fire. Detective Reinhardt must have smelled it at the same time because he winced and grunted, ordered Selim to stop. But Lyra had already turned. She'd already spotted a thread of smoke unwinding above the trees, back in the direction of the cabins, and she'd already started to run.
Gemma, 27. Gemma dreamed she was riding on the back of a giant bat, cupped in the soft leather of its wings. She dreamed that a veil had been placed over her face to keep her from looking down and getting afraid, to keep her from crying out and startling out of the sky. But she couldn't breathe. The cloth was wet from her breathing, and it flowed into her open mouth. It tasted like smoke. Briefly, she woke up to the sound of voices and lights, hands everywhere, leathery hands, unfamiliar, and faces she didn't know. But she hovered there, on the edge of consciousness, for only a few seconds before the bat enfolded her in its wings and once again swept her up, this time loosing itself from the trees and hurtling across the clean, cool night air. She could breathe again. The veil had come loose. Her sister had unhooked it because she didn't like how it looked. That's better, her sister Emma said, except that Emma had Lyra's face, and Gemma knew in her dream that all along Lyra, who was Emma, had simply disguised herself to give Gemma time to adjust to having a sister. The bat had turned to a trundling donkey, and Gemma rocked back and forth, while Lyra, who was her sister Emma, walked beside her. The sky above them was the color of milk. Was she dreaming or not? She was bound up in white sheets, as if prepared for burial, but she didn't feel afraid, not with her sister Lyra standing next to her and whispering to her over and over. Shh. It's okay. You're okay now.
Lyra, 27. Dimly, Lyra was aware of shouting. The gunshots must have drawn the attention of the searchers. She had been worried about coming across police officers in the woods. She was worried they would ask questions that Detective Reinhardt didn't know how to answer. But now she thought of nothing but Gemma, her friend. She saw through a break in the trees the architecture of the old cabins and the smoke coming from somewhere beyond them. She had approached from the back and had a view of collapsed stone timbers and a ruined hearth. She circled around to the front, completely mindless of the way her heart was jumping arrhythmically in her chest, mindless of the little moments of dark that shuttered her vision for seconds at a time. Gemma, Gemma, Gemma was the only rhythm she could hear. The long finger of smoke was all she could see. The ground was smoking, or at least that's what it looked like to her from a distance, but as she drew closer, she saw a blackened door laid flat over a lip of stone and the smoke flowing out from an opening beneath it. She dropped to her knees, soaking her jeans. She got her fingers around the old door and pushed, recoiling as the column of smoke thickened, carried up by a surge of air. Blinking to clear tears from her vision, she spotted a mass of uniforms coming toward her through the trees. Troopers, police officers, firefighters. Here! She screamed. At the bottom of a long well, Gemma was curled up next to a smoldering fire, which blew its thick smoke into the air. Lyra felt as if she were falling and leaving her body behind. Here! Here! It seemed to take forever for her to lift her hand. She saw it waving there, tethered to the narrow cable of her wrist, and it looked like a distant balloon, like something that didn't belong to her at all. Here! 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 She shouted again and again as all the uniformed men and women came toward her through a scrim of smoke. Maybe it was a trick of the smoke, or maybe not, but funnily enough, all those strangers fractured in her vision into a kaleidoscope of different angles, and she saw them coming toward her not as a wave, not as a group, but as individual points of color, as individual hands reaching to hold her, as individual arms that caught her just before she dropped.
Gemma, 28. Is it true? Did you really lose a finger? April didn't wait for Gemma to answer. That's so awesome! You got your finger blown off. Is it your middle finger?
Pinky, Gemma said.
Oh well, thank God, April said. How else would you flick off Chloe DeWitt and the Pack Wolves? Seriously, this is the most badass thing I've ever heard. You're going to be Instagram famous, like, immediately.
Sure, Gemma said. Maybe I'll even become a hand model.
Uh-huh. April fed a Twizzler into her mouth, then offered one to Gemma. Maybe I'll get my finger blown off, too. You know, so we can be twins.
Gemma rolled her eyes. You're certifiably insane. You know that? You should be locked up. But the knot in her chest had loosened. April had that effect, like a warm bath after you'd almost frozen to death. Since Gemma had woken up, nearly 18 hours since she'd first been admitted, time enough for April and her mothers to catch a flight to Philadelphia and then make the drive to Lancaster General, April had barely paused for breath. She told Gemma how her mom Diana had helped her crack into Jake's computer after April admitted the story they'd cooked up about finding it in the library was in fact a fabrication.
I should have known, Diana said. When's the last time you two were at the library?
It took her, like, 2 seconds,
April said, deliberately ignoring the question. Meanwhile, she can't use Snapchat to save her life. April had been hoping that there might be information on Jake's computer that would help them locate Gemma. Instead, she had found passwords to havenfiles.com, lists of bloggers and journalists who'd expressed interest in what was really happening at Haven, hundreds of names and connections, data that Jake, out of precaution, out of fear, had kept secret. But April, God love her, had never kept a secret in her whole life. She had flooded havenfiles.com with new uploads, had emailed every single whistleblower she could find online, had started a truth apocalypse, as she put it. Her mom, Angela, had even contacted the New York Times. "Some detective talked to me," she said. "He wanted to know all about the Haven Files, all about Jake Witz, too."
"Is April bugging you, Gemma?"
Diana said, ruffling her daughter's hair.
"Yeah," Gemma said, "for about the past 10 years.
She was kidding, of course, though in truth she didn't want to think about Jake Witz, or detectives, or the replicas escaped from the airport, and what would happen when the truth about them began to break. That would come later. For now, though, she liked to hear April's voice, and see Angela and Diana bickering over whose turn it was to run down to the canteen for coffee, and sit in the sun with her mother, clear-eyed, sitting next to her.
"Hardy-har!"
April made a face through a mouthful of Twizzler.
"All I'm saying is, when the shitstorm hits the—"
But she didn't finish, because just then the door opened behind her, and Lyra and Selim edged shyly into the room. Gemma's heart leapt. They were both wearing hospital gowns, and Lyra was painfully pale, and still far, far too thin. But she was smiling and alive. "Looks like you have some more visitors," Christina said, reaching out a hand and smoothing Gemma's hair back.
"You're awake,"
Gemma blurted. She had been asking since she had woken up that morning. April treated Lyra and Selim's arrival like she treated everything, as if it was exactly what she had expected all along.
"You're heroes,"
April said, and then held out her bag of Twizzlers.
"Twizzler?"
Lyra shook her head. Selim, however, took one, and Gemma couldn't help but smile.
"Come on."
Angela put a hand on April's shoulder. "Leave them alone for a bit, okay?" Gemma's mom stood up.
"I could use a cup of coffee, actually."
April made a face. Leaving Gemma alone was not a concept April had ever been particularly good at. It was one of the things Gemma loved most about her.
"Yeah, sure," she grumbled. "But we'll come back, right? You can't get rid of me that easily."
She pointed a Twizzler at Gemma.
"I wouldn't dream of it," Gemma said.
Lyra and Selim exchanged a look. She thought she saw a smile pass between them. Christina bent down to kiss Gemma's forehead.
"I'll be right back," she said,
and Gemma nodded to show it was okay for her to go.
"How are you?" Gemma asked as soon as everyone else had left. She was worried about how pale Lyra looked.
"How are you feeling?"
But Lyra answered immediately.
"We're fine," she said. Selim took Lyra's hand, and Gemma felt a surge of love for them both. She struggled to find the words to express how she felt, how grateful she was.
"April was right," she said at last. "You're both heroes. I can't believe you found me."
Slowly, Lyra smiled. It was the funniest thing. Her smile was like something that snuck up on her, like the kind of sun that begins by planting an elbow through the clouds, and then begins to push and push until the whole sky is exposed.
"That's what friends do," Lyra said. "They find each other."
Gemma knew then that Lyra understood, that the terrible things that had happened to her hadn't, after all, been more important than the love she had found.
"Exactly," she said.
Suddenly, unexpectedly, Lyra came forward and put her arms around Gemma's shoulders and squeezed. They had never hugged before. Gemma blinked away tears. She could feel Lyra's ribs through her back. She thought of a bird.
she thought of the dream of being carried to safety on a pair of wings. "Thank you," Lyra said twice. Then she pulled away, almost as if she was embarrassed. Without another word, she turned for the door. Selim lifted a hand and quirked his mouth into a smile and waved. Then they were gone. Not a minute after they left, Christina was back and fussing over Gemma. "She's going to be okay, isn't she?" Gemma asked, after Lyra had slipped out, promising to lie down. She was consumed by a strange anxiety, a premonition that she wouldn't see Lyra again, or that she wouldn't see her for a long time. Christina sighed. She looked down at her hands. "Lyra's very sick, Gemma."
"I know that," Gemma said. "That isn't what I meant."
But she wasn't sure what she did mean. She was scared all over again, scared and full of love. She knew she couldn't save Lyra, and that was the scariest thing of all.
"I wish I had the answers," Christina said. That was one of the things Gemma loved about her mom. She wasn't a liar.
Christina moved to the window and drew the curtains to let in the sun. Gemma blinked. Outside her window, a spider was weaving in one corner, putting the finishing touches on a web that looked like a blown-up snowflake.
"Your father called," she said at last, almost casually.
"He wants to talk to you."
"I don't want to see him," Gemma said. "I don't want to see him ever again."
"Well," Christina turned away from the window again. She had no makeup on. Gemma couldn't remember the last time she'd seen her mom with no makeup. She looked gorgeous, Gemma thought.
"You can't avoid him forever."
"Why not?" Gemma asked. Christina bit her lip. For a second, Gemma was sure, she had been about to smile. But she sighed instead and came toward the bed.
"Listen, Jem." This time when she brushed the hair out of Gemma's eyes, Gemma nearly cried. She'd missed her mom so badly. She'd been so afraid they'd never see each other again.
I want you to know, and I know this will be hard for you, but I don't think I'm going to go home. To your father, I mean. I think I'd like to get my own place. A place for just you and me."
Her throat was moving up and down, as if it was doing double duty just to get the words out.
"What do you say?"
"I know things will be different." But she didn't finish, because Gemma started to laugh and cry both, imagining a little house where she and her mother would live together. She and her mother and their animals, all covered in pet hair, and nothing white at all.
Lyra, 28. Lancaster General looked like the haven from her dreams, full of windows that let in long afternoon sunlight when the clouds eventually broke up, full of the reassuring squeak of footsteps and the smell of floor polish and fresh flowers. Lyra was placed in her own room and hooked up to an IV to deliver fluids and Zofran to get rid of her nausea. Her window looked out onto an interior garden, just like the one at Haven, except there was no faceless statue here. Just flowers and benches where visitors sat in the sun. The IV fluids made her feel better right away, and she began to drift, rising and falling through different dreams. In one, she and Selim lived in a white house that looked just like the one at April's grandparents, and Detective Reinhardt brought them mail, but every single one of the letters he delivered turned into a white bird and flew away. She woke up because she thought a bird wing swept across her face. It was dark already, and she was startled to see Christina Ives, Gemma's mother, draw away. "Sorry," she said. She looked embarrassed. "You were so still. I wanted to make sure you were all right." Lyra sat up in bed. For the first time in days, she wasn't nauseous, and movement didn't give her vertigo. A reading light was on in the corner, and Christina Ives had obviously been sitting there. Her purse was on the floor next to the chair, a magazine rolled up inside of it. "Where's Selim?" she asked.
"He went to check in on Detective Reinhardt. Both of them are fine," Christina said before Lyra could ask. "Detective Reinhardt was very lucky. The knife missed all his major organs." She smiled.
She looked very tired, but she was still extremely pretty. Lyra thought she was a little bit like the rose in The Little Prince. She'd been sheltered behind glass for a long time, but she was loyal. She knew what love was.
"I want to thank you," Christina went on. "You found Gemma. I can never repay you."
"You don't have to," Lyra said. "Gemma found me once. We're even."
To Lyra's surprise, Gemma's mother reached out and took her hand. Her skin was incredibly soft, and Lyra was shocked to recognize the scent. Lemon balm. Her expression changed, too. When she smiled, it was like light passing into a room through an open door.
"I want you to know I'm your friend," she said. "You can trust me to help you however I can. Do you believe me?"
Lyra nodded. She was overwhelmed by the tightness in her throat, and by the feeling at the same time that paper birds were winging up through her chest. The door opened, and Lyra turned to see Selim and Detective Reinhardt. The detective moved slowly, and a bulk of bandages was visible beneath his shirt, wrapping his abdomen. But he was smiling.
"You shouldn't be up," Christina said, releasing Lyra's hand with a final squeeze.
Detective Reinhardt waved her off.
"I'm good as new. The surgeon said so himself."
Selim came right to the bed.
"Hey,"
he said. He put a hand on Lyra's face, and she turned so she could kiss his palm.
"How are you feeling?"
"Better," she said. For once it wasn't a lie. "Much better."
"I'm going to go check on Gemma,"
Christina said. She picked up her purse and hugged it.
"I want to see her,"
Lyra said, sitting up a little straighter. "Can I come and see her?"
"Of course,"
Christina smiled. "She's just down the hall. You were the first person she asked about, you and Selim both." After she had left, Detective Reinhardt moved to the window, parting the blinds with a finger. Lyra thought he was giving Selim time to lean forward quickly and kiss her.
"You get some sleep?" Reinhardt asked, and Lyra nodded. "Incredible how different the world looks on the other side of a nice sleep, isn't it?"
She wanted to tell him about her dream, but she was too embarrassed. He eased into the chair in the corner, wincing a little. He waved off Selim's help.
"I'm okay,"
he said. But he sat for a long time with his chin down, eyes closed, breathing hard. Lyra even began to think he'd fallen asleep. Then, at last, he looked up.
"I'm afraid I have some news about your father."
Lyra knew just by looking at him what he was about to say.
"He's dead, isn't he?"
"Yes."
He looked her directly in the eyes. She liked that about him, that he wouldn't look away, even though she was sure he wanted to.
"Found at home, at the trailer park, only yesterday. Looks like an overdose."
"That's impossible!" Selim's voice leapt almost to a shout. "It's a trick!"
"Selim, please."
Reinhardt sighed. "I'm on your side, remember?" Selim wheeled away and went to stand by the window. Lyra wondered whether he was thinking about how he and Rick had fought. She knew he would be sorry he had never had the chance to apologize. She was surprised that she was the one who couldn't make eye contact with Detective Reinhardt. She looked down, blinking back her tears.
"I promise you, Lyra, I'll make sure your father gets his justice. I'll make sure you do. Do you believe me?"
She nodded. For a long time he said nothing. She liked that about him, too. He wasn't afraid of silence. He had learned to find comfort in it.
"They've still got those vultures by the main entrance waiting to pounce," he said.
There had been a crowd at the hospital when they arrived, police officers but also men and women holding phones, video equipment, cameras that went flash, flash.
"I don't imagine any of us are getting off easy."
The nurses had sworn that no one would be able to get to Lyra as long as she was in the hospital. She'd been worried initially that Jeffrey Ives or one of the other suits would simply creep in and murder her while she was sleeping. There were even police officers monitoring every visitor to and from this portion of the hospital. But what would happen once they left? Detective Reinhardt seemed to know what she was thinking.
"They're going to want to ask you questions," he said. "There's going to be a lot of nosing around. I expect a department inquiry." "Well, I asked for a department inquiry,"
Lyra had worried that Detective Reinhardt might be disappointed when he found out she had stolen from Dr. O'Donnell's desk drawer, but instead he had hugged her. He had lied for her, too, and told the state troopers who found Calliope's body that he'd been the one to shoot her after she rushed him with a knife. "There's no hiding this anymore," he told Lyra on their way to the hospital as she drifted in and out of consciousness. "There's no covering up." "I don't blame you," Detective Reinhardt went on now. "If you had other things on your mind, things you wanted to do, for example." Detective Reinhardt was looking intently at his cuticles. That was how Lyra understood he was giving them a way out. He understood she didn't have much time left. "I like buses," she said. Selim took her hand. "I wouldn't mind riding some buses again." Detective Reinhardt heaved out of his chair using both arms for leverage. "Amazing things," he said. "You can go coast to coast on the Greyhound bus line from Maine to Santa Monica. Did you know that?" He started limping toward the door. "Of course, they won't discharge you yet. Not without wanting to know your story. And the front entrance is crawling with press." He paused by the door, turning back to smile at Lyra, and she saw in his expression love. Actual love. The kind she'd felt for him in the woods. She barely knew him at all. But he was family. "Of course, that's the problem with hospitals. Always have to be a million exits because of fire regulations. You can't cover them all. I saw a stairwell right by the ladies' room, led right down into the parking lot, not a single person standing guard." "Thank you," Selim said. Detective Reinhardt nodded. Then he turned around and fished something from his pocket. "Oh," he said. "I had one of the nurses run out and pick this up. Thought it might come in handy. Pay as you go? No code?" He tossed a cell phone in the air and it landed at the foot of Lyra's bed. "Don't worry, my number's already in there." It was brand new, made of plastic and had little numbered buttons. It had a fake leather case, which snapped closed and could hook to a belt. Lyra's throat closed up entirely. "Thank you," she tried to say, but she couldn't get the words out. Detective Reinhardt seemed to understand. He touched his fingers to his forehead, once, a kind of salute, and was gone. Lyra didn't need to ask where Gemma's room was. All she and Selim had to do was listen for the babble of April's voice. Though Lyra didn't know April well, she knew her voice right away. April was sitting at Gemma's bedside. With her were two women Lyra assumed must be related to April. One of them had April's warm brown eyes and the same nest of curly hair. The other one kept a hand on April's shoulder. "Looks like you have some more visitors," Christina said when Lyra and Selim entered. She, too, had drawn a chair up to Gemma's bedside. "You're awake," Gemma said, sitting up. She was pale but smiling. "You're heroes," April said through a mouthful of candy, pivoting around to face her. "Twizzler?" Lyra shook her head, but Selim took one. "Come on." The woman with the curly hair gave April a nudge. "Let's leave them alone for a bit, okay?" Christina took the hint and stood up. "I could use a cup of coffee, actually." April frowned. "Yeah, sure, but we'll come back, right?" She pointed a Twizzler at Gemma. "You can't get rid of me that easily." "I wouldn't dream of it," Gemma said and rolled her eyes. Christina bent down to kiss her daughter's forehead. "I'll be right back," she said. Lyra almost laughed. She nearly cried, too. The sun through the blinds looked almost solid. It was beautiful, she thought. It was all so beautiful. She would miss Gemma. Maybe Selim knew what she was thinking because he reached for Lyra's hand and squeezed. "How are you?" Gemma asked after the others had left. "How are you feeling?" It was so like Gemma. She was the one who had nearly died and still she was worried about Lyra. "We're fine," she said. Selim's hand was warm in hers. It was both true and not true, of course. She was still dying, of a disease for which there was no cure. But it was like Selim had said. She wasn't dead yet. Not today. Already the words she'd taken from Dr. O'Donnell were beginning to turn, to flow, to do their work. "April was right," Gemma said. "You're both heroes. I can't believe you found me." Lyra wondered whether anyone had told her about Calliope. She knew that Gemma would be sorry, even though Calliope was broken, even though Calliope had killed people. That was the kind of person Gemma was.